start out with kind of a funny. The sign reads, "This life is a test. It is only a test. If it had been an actual life, you would have received further instructions on where to go and what to do." I would like to read from the opening prayer of the glorious Quran. It's read at the beginning of most all celebrations. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, Lord of the worlds, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Owner of the Day of Judgment, Thee alone we worship, Thee alone we ask for help. Show us the straight way, the path of those whom Thou hast favored, not the path of those who earn Thy anger or those who go astray. In the month of April, I took a pilgrimage down to San Diego, and one of the great souls that I met there was Prem, who is a grandson of Swami Ram Dass, who was just a tremendously God-realized individual. And at that time, I got a command, you might say, as Papa Ram Dass would say, from God, to leave the place of where I've been working for the last 12 years and to take time in order to devote myself more full-time to this work, and specifically around some of the writings of Mother Hamilton and to turn those into book form, and also just to be able to visit devotees more often. So I told God at the time, I says, "Well, I have no idea how this will work. You will have to show me the way." And since that time, I've just had the attitude of just being God's child and totally helpless in His hands. And so I really received this letter Excuse me, I may have to go upstairs and get another. I grabbed the wrong one. I come along with it. And I get so filled up with that, it's difficult to stay in touch with the material world. Sri Yukteswar said that God realization is not stupidity, but I've sometimes wanted to debate that with him in my own case. My brain doesn't always work just so when I'm in those states. But this is a letter from Swami Satchitananda, who is a direct disciple of Papa Ram Dass, and we exchanged some wonderful letters. But without his knowing about, or at least in an outward sense, without me letting him know about this change in my life that's coming up, this is the letter that he wrote to me. And he starts out with a quote from Swami Ram Dass. "Change is the order of the universe. The how and the where of events, great and small, happening in the world are questions which do not admit of any answer. The Lord's will is supreme in all things." Your loving letter of 22nd April was duly received. Glad you, Larry, and Kate visited California, where Marge Rani played host to you all and took you to Prem and Sheila, who poured on you all their love and affection. It is good that you visited SRF centers and Mission of San Juan Capistrano, and also a Zen monastery on Mount Baldy. From what you have written, I can imagine how much you must have enjoyed the visit and how much all of you were spiritually helped. The places where saints have lived or where they have their samadhis are full of spiritual vibration. Those who are real aspirants and are receptive to such vibration are very much benefited. When we are in such places, we are, without effort, transported to higher realms, free from the pull of the lower nature. We get a glimpse of our true goal and are very forcefully inspired to sacrifice everything for attaining that goal. That is why devotees, especially in India, visit the samadhis of saints regularly. You have been on the spiritual path and have been guided by eminent masters. the manifestation of the one seated in your heart. When you are serious on the path, he will guide you from within and without unerringly. From within, he will prompt you to do certain things for your further spiritual progress. From without, he will bring about the external circumstances in such a way as to enable you to act according to the inner promptings. In fact, in the life of an aspirant, a stage comes when he feels there is nothing that can be called mundane. Everything is spiritual. Whatever work you do is your spiritual practice. Whomever you meet or think of is a manifestation of God. Everything is God. You are dealing with God only in different forms. At this stage, it makes no difference for an aspirant whether he prays in the church, worships in a temple, serves the sick, cooks in the kitchen, serves food, does work in the office, holds satsang, attends satsang, or does any type of activity, because whatever he does, he deals with God only. This practice itself gives so much joy and peace to the aspirant that he is fully satisfied and wants to remain in that state only, constantly. But God will lead him further to a higher experiences with his manifest, leading to the realization of his perfect oneness with him, and therefore oneness with his manifestation, the entire universe. So leave yourself in his safe hands. Hearty blessings on you for all success in your spiritual journey and the speedy realization of your cherished goal. So it's as if he was speaking directly to my own soul and to my own circumstances. You know, for these great saints, there is no thing as time or space or distance. I'd like to read you something that I wrote in May 27th. O Lord, you have inspired me to live simply as a child, a seeker after you. You who art all in all will surely look after my needs. I leave the past behind, cutting tethers of attachment to each memory dream. I look not to the future. It is you who will write those chapters through this form. I know only now, I know only your presence creeping inside me, glowing within me. When I let go of my will and make it thy will, I travel the sure path to you. You, O my Lord, are my heart and the love I feel. Your signature is on my thoughts. I do all for you. I have sold myself into slavery to you in order that I might do all for you. I do not know outcomes. That is up to you. I do not know the means by which anything is done. Again, that is up to you. I only know you, your presence, your love, your wisdom, guided thoughts. All flows from you, through you, and back to you again. Therefore, nothing is gained or lost. Only the joy of your presence and being your expression is real. O my Lord, my God, I pray but one thing. Keep me in humble submission to your will. All my love, my thoughts, my life, I offer at your feet. I was awakened about 3 a.m., and that just came spontaneously to me. So it's wonderful when you get up at night. You know, when the world becomes still at nighttime, it's oftentimes a wonderful time to go inside. All the bustling vibrations of the world calm down, and you feel your unity and your oneness with that infinite presence right within you. It all works for the higher good. Reading from the autobiography of the yogi on the Christ-like life of Lari Mahasya. Unknown to society in general, a great spiritual renaissance began to flow from a remote corner of Benares. Just as the fragrance of flowers cannot be suppressed, so Lari Mahasya, quietly living as an ideal householder, could not hide his innate glory. Slowly, from every part of India, the devotee bees sought the divine nectar of the liberated master. The English office superintendent was one of the first to notice a strange transcendental change in his employee, whom he endearingly called ecstatic Babu. "Sir, you seem sad. What is the trouble?" Lari Mahasya made the sympathetic inquiry one morning to his employer. "My wife in England is critically ill. I am torn with anxiety." "I shall get you some word about her." Lari Mahasya left the room and sat for a short time in a secluded spot. On return, he smiled consolingly. "Your wife is improving. She is now writing you a letter." The omniscient yogi quoted some parts of the missive. "Ecstatic Babu, I already know you are no ordinary man, yet I am unable to believe that, at will, you can banish time and space." The promised letter finally arrived. The astounded superintendent found that it contained not only the good news of his wife's recovery, but also the same phrases which, weeks earlier, Lari Mahasya had repeated. The wife came to India some months later. She visited the office where Lari Mahasya was sitting quietly at his desk. The woman approached him reverently. "Sir," she said, "it was your form, haloed in glorious light, that I beheld months ago by my sickbed in London. At that moment, I was completely healed. Soon after, I was able to undertake the long ocean voyage to India." Day after day, one or two devotees besought the sublime guru for a Kriya initiation. In addition to these spiritual duties and to those of his business and family life, the great master took an enthusiastic interest in education. He organized many study groups and played an active role in the growth of a large high school in the Bengal section of Benares. His regular discourses on the scriptures came to be called his Gita Assembly, eagerly attended by many truth seekers. By these manifold activities, Lari Mahasya sought to answer the common challenge. After performing one's business and social duties, where is the time for devotional meditation? The harmoniously balanced life of the great householder guru became the silent inspiration of thousands of questioning hearts. Earning only a modest salary, thrifty, accessible to all, the master carried on naturally and happily in the path of the worldly life. Though ensconced in the seat of the Supreme One, Lari Mahasya showed reverence to all men, irrespective of their differing merits. When his devotees saluted him, he bowed and turned to them. With childlike humility, the master often touched the feet of others, but seldom allowed them to pay him similar honor. Even though such obeisance toward the guru is an ancient Oriental custom. A significant feature of Lari Mahasya's life was his gift of Kriya initiation to those of every faith. Not Hindus only, but Muslims and Christians were among his foremost disciples. Monists and dualists, those of all faiths or no established faith, were impartially received and instructed by the universal guru. One of his highly advanced cellists was Abdul Ghaffar Khan, a Mohammedan. It shows great courage on the part of Lari Mahasya that, although a high caste Brahmin, he tried his utmost to dissolve the rigid caste bigotry of his time. Those from every walk of life found shelter under the master's omnipresent wings. Like all God-inspired prophets, Lari Mahasya gave new hope to the outcasts and downtrodden of society. Always remember that you belong to no one, and no one belongs to you. Reflect that someday you will suddenly have to leave everything in this world. So make the acquaintanceship of God now, the great guru told his disciples. Prepare yourself for the coming astral journey of death by daily riding in the balloon of God perception. Through delusion, you are perceiving yourself as a bundle of flesh and bones, which at best is a nest of troubles. Meditate unceasingly, that you may quickly behold yourself as the infinite essence, free from every form of misery. Cease being a prisoner of the body. Using the secret key of Kriya, learn to escape into spirit. The great guru encouraged his various students to adhere to the good traditional discipline of his own faith, stressing the all-inclusive nature of Kriya as a practical technique of liberation. Lahari Mahasya then gave his cellists liberty to express their lives in conformance with environment and upbringing. A Muslim should perform his namaz worship four times daily, the master pointed out. Four times daily, a Hindu should sit in meditation. A Christian should go down on his knees four times daily, praying to God and then reading the Bible. With wise discernment, the guru guided his followers into the paths of bhakti, devotion, karma, action, yoni, wisdom, or raja, royal or complete yogas, according to each man's natural tendencies. The master, who was slow to give his permission to devotees, wishing to enter the formal path of monkhood, always cautioned them to first reflect well on the austerities of the monastic life. The great guru taught his disciples to avoid theoretical discussions of the scriptures. He only is wise who devotes himself to realizing, not reading only, the ancient revelations, he said. Solve all your problems through meditation. Exchange unprofitable religious speculations for actual God contact. Clear your mind of dogmatic theological debris. Let in the fresh healing waters of direct perception. Attune yourself to the active inner guidance. The divine voice has the answer to every dilemma of life. Though man's ingenuity for getting himself into trouble appears to be endless, the infinite succor is no less resourceful. The master's omnipresence was demonstrated one day before a group of disciples who were listening to his exposition of the Bhagavad Gita. As he was explaining the meaning of Kustasha Chaitanya, or Christ consciousness, in all vibratory creation, Lari Mahasya suddenly gasped and cried out, "I am drowning in the bodies of many souls off the coast of Japan." The next morning, the chalice read a newspaper account of the death of many people whose ship had floundered the preceding day near Japan. The distant disciples of Lari Mahasya were often made aware of his enfolding presence. "I am ever with those who practice Kriya," he said consolingly to chelas who could not remain near him. "I will guide you to the cosmic home through your enlarging perceptions." Swami Satyananda was told by a devotee unable to go to Benares, the man had nevertheless received precise Kriya initiation in a dream. Lari Mahasya had appeared to instruct the chela in answer to his prayers. If a disciple neglected any of his worldly obligations, the master would gently correct him and discipline him. Lari Mahasya's words were mild and healing, even when he is forced to speak openly of a chela's faults, Sri Yukteswar once told me. He added ruefully, "No disciple ever fled from our master's barbs." I could not help laughing, but I truthfully assured Sri Yukteswar that, sharp or not, his every word was music to my ears. I've come to speak to you this evening on direct God perception. This task that we take on to realize our oneness with God is the greatest path possible. It is the greatest adventure, and it is also the greatest challenge. There are few in this world, it is said, who gain the total, complete, universal vision. Of the many thousands and thousands who live, there are one here and there who look to find God at all. And of those many who seek out God, there is only one here and there that get direct God perception fully and completely. Now, what does that mean to have full universal vision? It means that all sense of duality, all sense of me and mine has been completely eliminated. And what occurs then is a complete universal vision. In that universal vision, we see all of creation and beyond as expression of the one infinite divine mind. Now, we use the word God in a very specific manner. There are many who speak about God without having direct perception of God. But when you, within your devotional meditation prayer, are uplifted in body, mind, and spirit, you feel yourself in communion with that infinite spirit. Your mind is lifted up, and you have divinely inspired thoughts. You feel the divine current running through your spine and your brain and your entire body. Indeed, you do not even feel as if you are this material body anymore, but you are that spiritual current that has originally formed this body. In the heart, you feel God's love pouring through your heart out toward all humanity and beyond, because every aspect you realize in that divine love of creation is a manifestation of divine consciousness. When Jesus was told to silence his disciples for singing out Hosanna, praising to the highest, Jesus responded by saying, "Silence these disciples, and the very rocks will sing out." And in truth, that is always happening. The rocks themselves that are surrounding us are singing with God's vibration. When you are lifted up in God consciousness, you hear these inner vibrations resounding in your inner or your spiritual ears. You can hear the sound of Om, which is said to be the sound of many rushing waters in the Bible. It comes to you in this high-pitched E sound, and it is the purity of God's expression through vibration. Now, in each one of the chakras, you experience a different sound. Sometimes you will hear a very high-pitched flute coming in. And at other times you will feel or you will hear the roar of the ocean. At other times you will feel and hear the deep bumblebee. The reason that I'm confusing this feeling and hearing is because in this state you can hear through your feelings and you can feel through your hearing. You can also feel through your sight and you can see through your feelings. So what is distinct and separate in this material world becomes fused into one way of knowing within the spiritual world. So this upliftment in consciousness is something that can occur. Now, just because it is rare doesn't mean it doesn't exist. And because there are few who have direct God perception, it doesn't mean that it's an impossibility. There are those who will say, well, these scriptures were written many thousand years ago by superstitious individuals who didn't have a clue. They were just making things up as they went along. Originally, they worshipped fire, and then they worshipped water, and then the sun, and finally they made up this stern father who was sitting off in some distant part of the cosmos that was there to punish people. But prophets down through the ages have brought with them their direct God perception. And because it is tuned to the society and to the language and to the people of that time, today that expression may seem archaic. But at that time, it was a direct God perception. Also, so many of the scriptures down through the centuries have undergone changes. For instance, there is no Bible ever written in English. It was first in Aramaic, and then parts of it were in Greek, and those went through translations. And we don't have any of the original writings from that time. Those original writings even came from folklore at the time. So that we have a direct perception in that sense of even what these prophets brought to us cannot be. Also, they taught in parable form. This has been the greatest form of teaching down through the ages. To get this teaching, we cannot rely solely on what we know about this world, because this spiritual world contains the material world, but it also exists beyond it. So the only means that we have for knowing things in this human life form, when we first start out on the spiritual path, is through thinking about things in a material way. That is why these fanciful images of God sitting as a father looking down on the earth, handing out judgment and all the rest of it, has come down to us, because perhaps at one time that was man's highest conception of which he was able to achieve. But also, they reveal a deeper truth, that when you see the Father God as spirit unmanifest, in other words, beyond creation, the original purity of spirit before it came into material creation, as the Father. And God the Mother is the expression of God, or Mother Nature, and that is slowing that vibration of spirit down until it condenses into material form. And out of light, God has formed all this material nature around us. Now, to our eyes and our senses, these material objects that we are sitting on, these chairs, these couches, the table in front of us, and all the rest of it, appear to be solid. But as physicists have been able to tell us, if you were able to look on a deeper level, you would see that they are small, tiny, minuscule atoms that are all made up of even smaller particles, and some of them are just electrical charges. And then you even have smaller particles than that that are flying through the whole bunch of it. So that we have particles that fly right through us and all the way through the earth every moment, and yet we're not aware of it. And that what appears to be solid to us is only so because it is vibrating at a rate similar to our body. Therefore, it takes on the appearance of solidity. Now, when that vibration is even faster and it expands, we call it a gas. And when it is a little bit slower, then it is liquid. And so we have all these different variety of vibrations around us. But if you've ever seen a chart that portrays how much light spectrum there is and how much is available for our visual sight, you see that it's just a minuscule aspect of what the actual light spectrum is. And so how would we know that unless we had scientists who were able to investigate those realms? In the same way, we've had spiritual scientists who have been able to investigate the spiritual realms. And because this body and this consciousness is equipped with a way of perceiving things that go beyond these five senses, these great yogi scientists — yoga means union, or to be yoked with. It is one who practices a discipline in order to have spiritual realization of who and what they truly were. So these great yogi scientists were able to perceive deeper into the nature of things. And they were able to see in deeply into the nature of the material universe, but actually they were able to go beyond that. They saw that we are made up not just of this material body, but we also have what is called an astral or electrical body. This astral body is a cluster of life force and vibration that operates at a much higher rate than this material body. And this is the nature that we are when we leave this body at the time of death or at the time of the mini-death or sleep. And so we leave this body and we rise up into this electrical, this astral body. And believe it or not, beyond this material creation exists this vast astral creation. And there we are told that there is this incredibly beautiful universe and universes beyond, of which there is incredible beauty and there is more harmony, and that people are divided up within their own categories of their own vibrational rate. It is here on earth that we are subjected to the great variety that we see here. And so we see human beings that live barely out of the animalistic state. They go from one day to the next in pure survival with no thought of anything beyond. And then we see others who have an extremely high moral nature and try to live their lives that way. And then we see others that are living a spiritual life guided directly by direct intuition perception of God realization that is constantly flowing out to all. But in order to perceive that, you have to refine this human instrument, this body, this mind, this heart, in order to be receptive to those vibrations. It is as if you had a small antenna that only picked up certain receptions from television signals, and so you got so many channels. But then you were able to procure for yourself one of these dish satellites that is able to pick up hundreds of channels. Suddenly your consciousness and your whole reality shifts as you are able to pick up these greater realities. And so it is with these yogi scientists. They were able to see that there are these greater realities that existed beyond just this material universe. Beyond the astral universe is said to be this causal or the mental universe. Here, vibration is so refined that there is nothing that is visible, so to speak. It is only seen through the mind, not through any sensory apparatus, not even intuitive sensory apparatus, but it goes beyond that even. And so these vast spheres of causal heavens exist, and beyond that is the purity of spirit, unmanifest, vibrational, massive, surging with intelligence, surging with bliss, ananda, and love, bhakti. And so these states are available to us even as we have bodies here on earth. And so Jesus said, in my Father's house are many mansions. And so these are a variety of level of vibrational creation. And we become so focused on just this one, this material body, and all the demands of this body. I'm hungry one moment. I'm cold the next moment. I'm sore the next moment. I have pleasure the next moment. I have pain the next moment. And on it goes. And we never give a second thought so often to anything higher, to anything greater. This great yogic science that has been handed down to us through Kriya Yoga and through deep meditation puts us in a way that we can begin to touch into these divine realms if we but use it. Now, we can be given the very best tools in the entire world, but if we don't utilize it, it won't do us one bit of good. There was a time in my life when I collected hand tools and woodworking tools and all the rest of it. And usually it was the case with me that I would get them and, you know, they would be fine for a little while and I'd use them and be interested. And then the thrill would wear off and I'd move on and there it'd sit up in the cupboard. And I could sit there for years while it fell into disuse. In order to make full usage of the tools we have, we need to put them into practice, and best of all, daily. Every day, you have an inner temple. You have a temple of peace. You have a temple of joy. You have a temple of God-inspired thoughts that is constantly available to you. But because we have this preoccupation with those things of the world, we don't even pay any attention to it. The delusive belief comes in where we think that when we attain a certain status in this world, when we have the right person in this world to compliment us, when we have the right children or the right house or all the rest of it, then we will be happy. But I tell you this, your happiness only exists here. It only exists now. To believe that happiness exists in the future and you sacrifice it in the now is a delusive thing. Because as I mentioned in this writing tonight, God flows out from himself, sustains himself, and withdraws himself into himself. And actually, there is no gain and there is no loss in the whole thing. There is only the beauty and the love of expression. So who you are right now, in body, mind, and soul, is the full expression of divinity. Only you have not realized it. You have become deluded into thinking you are just this person with this particular name, with this particular body, with this particular way of doing things and habits in the world. But when you wake up to your freedom, you realize you are so much more. That is merely the tip of the iceberg. Have you ever met an individual and at first you kind of discounted them or you didn't give them much notice? And then suddenly in something that they said or in some course of the conversation, you realize they were quite an interesting individual, that they had lived quite a life. And they had many things to offer. They had learned great things along the way and so on. So oftentimes when we look at people in this life, we just look at the outer physical parts. I know some people who have something about people who put on extra weight. And if they have extra weight on them, they don't give them the time of the day. They are just disgusted by it and they don't want anything to do with them. Others, unless you believe the way they do politically or unless you believe the way they do philosophically, they won't have anything to do with you. They discount you. They write you off. But every one of us is a divine creation. Every one of us, regardless of our looks, regardless of our outer prestige, regardless of our education and all the rest of it, has that innate God quality, that spiritual vibration that is vibrating within them. And we are so much more than just an iceberg. We just see the tip of what the body is, of what the outer expression is. But each and every one of us is God in human form. Each and every one of us are an expression. Now, this is not an egotistical kind of thing. Well, I am God, therefore something else. We are all God. We have all come from that creative intelligence, only we haven't realized it. So it is not a thing of the ego. It is not something to become puffed up in. But rather, it is something to realize. It is something to know about yourself. Now, in order to know this, we need to turn aside from things of this world. We need to be able to go into our inner temple, and within that inner temple of quiet, be open and receptive to the voice of God that is constantly vibrating out towards us. You know, the voice of God isn't necessarily an outer voice like the voice that I'm using now. But it is the vibration that permeates this entire universe. And so we have nowhere to go. We need not go to any distant city for some kind of devotional pilgrimage. As we read tonight in Swamiji's letter, it can be beneficial to go to spiritual places because they are charged very concretely with that spiritual vibration. And when you are attuned to it, when you are a devotee of God's, then you can feel that. You can walk into a place, my own teacher place where she lived, I could walk into that place and it was just charged with that vibration. You could feel it. Whenever I was in her presence, you could feel that vibration just emanating out from her. And whatever she was involved with, whether it was laugh or play or meditation or God talk or talking about somebody's house or decorating somebody's house or all the rest of it, there was that God vibration that was there. In the beginning, we seek to reflect something of the light of God within our own soul. But as we progress, we not only reflect that, but we begin to manifest it until we are a bright, glowing flame of that spiritual consciousness. Now, this is nothing that we have to guess at. It is nothing that we have to try to divine. It comes as an experience that is so powerful, it is unmistakable. Now, it is common in the beginning that when you get this touch of spiritual experience, this vibration, you wonder, is this something of the imagination or is it something that's real? And this is a very common thing to have happen. But this is just the beginning touches of it. And it should be an inspiration. It should be something that encourages you to go further on your own spiritual path. But you should not stop until you have the full universal vision, that you feel that presence in you always, and that you see everything as a manifestation of spiritual consciousness. So then you do not see individuals just as individuals, but as manifestations and expressions of the divine, be they naughty or be they good. It does not matter. It is just as if that a king left his palace and wandered out amongst his people. And he put on clothes so that he would blend in with everyone else. It nevertheless does not change the fact that he is the king. Now, if he were to fall down and go into amnesia and forget that he's king, then he might live as just one of all the other people until his memory is recovered. It is even so with you. You are that original, first, creative, spiritual essence that has come out from the oneness of spiritual consciousness and has been made manifest into a human body, taking on an individualized soul. But when you turn your attention inwardly, you begin to feel that upliftment, that peace, that love, that wisdom. And when you do, then you know you are truly putting your feet on the spiritual path. Now, this is not the end. This is but the beginning. And what begins to happen is a step-by-step spiritual purification of your body, of your mind, of your soul. As you feel the spiritual current come within you, and this kundalini force or the serpent force awakened within you, you see, we are told in the Old Testament, in the beginning, with Adam and Eve, which is a symbolic parable of what happens to material, to consciousness when it sinks into the material world, that the snake or the serpent was sentenced to crawl upon its belly. Now, what God showed me about this was that this means that that kundalini force or that serpent force stays at the base of the spine in a dormant state and cannot rise up, so to speak, up through the spine. And so it kept in your belly, in the belly of man, down at the base of the spine. But as Jesus said, even as Moses raised up the serpent in the desert, so must the Son of Man be raised up. So you raise up the serpent force, or this kundalini force gets stimulated and starts coursing up through your spine. And when that happens, you begin to feel a great heat. The first time that that occurred for me, I was in a group meditation. And as I was in a great, this devotional fervor, I had been reading about the saints of Ramakrishna and Saint Francis, and they had inspired me to seek out God through love. And so I was just reaching out to God in this way. And suddenly there was like a snap at the base of my spine. And at my third eye point here, the Ajna Center, the Christ Center, it just heated up. And I could have swore at the time I could have cooked eggs on it. It was just that hot. It felt like a frying pan. And so this was the beginning of the awakening of this kundalini energy within me. But this is just the beginning. As this force comes up, this life force within you, I wondered why it was referred to as a serpent force. And sometimes you see it pictured. I was wondering why I saw these depictions of this serpent as this life force coming up from the base of the spine. If you see an Egyptian pictography, for instance, and you'll see that the kings there have a serpent coming out of their crown there right at the third eye point. You'll see in Buddhism that there's a serpent that comes up and over the head of the Buddha. And sometimes you'll see depictions of seven serpents in that way, and oftentimes cobras. And if you have a fear of snakes, they can be a little disconcerting to see these depictions. But these depict a great inner truth. It is the awakening of the spiritual force within you. Anyway, one time when I was deep in meditation, the serpent force was active within me. And what it would make me do at times is it would make me rotate from the torso up in circular patterns, and sometimes just my head. because I didn't really want to publicize it at all, when I would go to Mother Hamilton's talks, I would sit way in the back so that no one would notice this kind of strange movement. I never knew what was going to happen next. And so as I sat rotating around like this from my torso up, within my inner vision, I was able to see straight from the top of my head all the way down my spine. And I saw from the top this image of a cobra-like snake that was coming up my spine in this rotating way. And it wasn't frightening or gross or anything. It was fascinating to be able to look from the top of my head with this inner vision and see this serpent force coming up. And so for whatever reason, this is the form and the image that this force takes on within the body. And so you see it depicted all around the world in all the different religions. So it's something that's universal. This path that we follow is something that is absolutely universal. It honors every religion, every great religion, every thought that is focused upon fully realizing God. There are many who teach in between steps, who emphasize getting involved in the psychic levels and gaining powers and all the rest of it. This path and all the great religions teach the same thing, which is those things are obstructions to the full realization of your own oneness with God. Jesus told us to seek ye first the kingdom of heaven. All these other things will be added unto you. So that these natural phenomena of intuition, of spiritual powers and all the rest of it, is something that comes to you. But as an individual, as an ego, you have nothing to do with it. If God chooses to express himself through you, through these powers, that's fine, but take no ownership of it. Do not allow your desire nature to get caught up with it. And it can be quite enticing when you come into touch with these realms, because these are things that appeal to the ego. They make you feel large. They make you feel powerful. But really, you only accumulate karma, or the law of cause and effect. As you sow, so shall you reap. All describe the same law. You just accumulate karma on a higher level. And it is something that is even more difficult to get yourself out of. It is even now, as we have developed atomic energies, that we have so much more creative power, but we also have so much more destructive power. And so it demands us to use it with greater wisdom. So for those who are seeking out their full God realization, powers and all the rest of it, even visions, and those things, as they come to you, you can accept them, you can thank God for them, but don't get attached to them. Keep on moving. And if you do, and you dedicate yourself towards realizing this great spiritual consciousness within you, you will be surely brought to the feet of God. And there, all the mysteries and all the revelations, all the love of God, all the bliss of God, all the wisdom of God, everything will be yours. But you will feel as a little child, and you will just put yourself simply at the feet of God, saying, do with me as you will, Lord. I am your servant. I am here to serve all of humanity, all of creation, in whatever way you inspire me to. It may be by talking, it may not be by keeping silent. It may be by actions, it may be by keeping from actions. You see, when you are charged inwardly and spiritually with that spiritual power and that vibration, it makes no difference, the expression, only how it chooses to express itself through you. So you can work in this life. You can keep your job and keep your family and all the rest of it. But inwardly, you are silently detached. Ramakrishna gave a little bit of a shocking analogy one time. He says, it is like the man who has a mistress, and he carries with him all through the day the thought of that mistress wherever he goes, and when he goes to his family even, he is thinking of his mistress alone. When he is at work, when he is traveling, she is always on his mind. Even so, God is your secret mistress. And that whatever you do, wherever you go, that is your secret beloved, deep within your own heart. And your heart is constantly humming, unheard by any, God, God, God. So let me stop there. And I'd like to just open it up to any questions and answers at this point. And those of you who are new, or those of you who are practicing and have some questions about your practice, whoever might be brave enough to ask. Sometimes if you're like me, your mind is just not hardly there.
One thing that I've been wanting to ask you about is that on a couple of your talks, you urged people to get onto the path.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get going.
Yes.
And I felt overwhelmed when you talked about it, and so I was you know, what that is for me. And I was thinking that, you know, on the one hand, we're all on our sacred path, and we're all going to reach the end because it's not a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when you're urging people, I do have a sense of, you know, your joy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I also urge my friends to get going in different ways, and I realize it's hard on them.
Mm-hmm.
And for myself, I think that when people are accepting of where I'm at,
mm-hmm.
and when they see me in a true way and have compassion for where I am, it's easier for me to take my next step.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I feel like I do better with acceptance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Buddha urged the path of compassion, and to see the world with compassion and all sentient beings, and I would go even beyond that and say all of creation you see with compassion. And if compassion is the thing that calls you most strongly and makes you feel most connected to your spirit, then that is your path. And so to meditate on compassion, to meditate on acceptance, would be then the thing that calls you most strongly and puts you most closely in touch with your spirit. And so just simply follow what comes naturally to you. Mm-hmm. There is so much, you know, that we've been taught growing up, and all the different things, the do's and the don'ts and all the rest of it, and how God is, and all these different kinds of descriptions, oftentimes from individuals who've had no access to spiritual realms, but they read books. They're perhaps good people, and they do the best that they know how. But we get inoculated with, or rather we just get permeated with all kinds of thoughts about what the spiritual path is and what it is not. And the truth is that we right now are spiritual beings. There is a saying that path presupposes distance. Therefore, it makes me laugh to even talk of a path, because there is no distance. That spiritual essence that you are made up of is in you now. And whatever awakens that within you, whatever awakens that joy, whatever awakens that acceptance, whatever awakens that compassion can be your path. So you don't need to superimpose onto yourself onerous tasks to do that make it difficult or that make it distant in order to know God. And yet at the same time, there is this resistive force within ourselves that wants to contain, that wants to close down, that wants to keep isolated from those spiritual vibrations, because the individualized part of us is fearful that if it expands into the universal self, it will disappear, it will become a nothing, that really was what at our core and our essence is something that's ugly or despicable, or, you know, there's all kinds of fears that are involved in becoming the spiritual essence that we are. So we do find that we're in this tug of war between forces internal. And so it does require effort. It does require focused attention. And it does require 100% commitment. But it shouldn't be towards things that make you feel foreign to yourself or alien. It should be to those things that inspire you and uplift you. So you can take the very things. You know, I like popular music and things like that. And so what I did is that if it was a love song that was being sang, then I would just make it a love song to God. If it was a song about you done me wrong and you dumped me and you're terrible kind of thing, that was a song about Maya, about delusion and about how we get fooled by that and how it lets us down. And we get disappointed about things in the world. And so just translated those songs into spiritual songs, and yet they're the songs that are all around us. So our very lives are made up of the very stuff of which our devotion and our path can be made up of. It's not like we have to learn a foreign language or become somebody different. We can just be exactly where we're at, utilize the stuff of what we're made up of. If we're involved in business and the outer life, we don't have to go away from that. We can make that business our service towards God in human form. If we build homes, or if we provide a service, if we're a waiter or a waitress or whatever it is that we're called on to do, that's our service to humanity. And when we take it that way, we put our minds on God in whatever we do. And so we utilize the very stuff of which our life is made up of right now, and we make it manifesting spiritual consciousness. So we don't need to make it hard. And I understand your dilemma. That can be a good indicator that you may have, you know, in one of the psychological paths that I studied, which is psychosynthesis, they talk about subpersonalities. And one of the subpersonalities is a pseudo-spiritual subpersonality. And it's the, you know, demanding old man, you know, you'd better do this and you'd better do that and you'd better live your life just like this or you're in trouble. And it's not a true spiritual personality. It's a pseudo-personality. And it can come across to us in lots of different ways. And so the thing to do is that when we're in touch with God, we feel peaceful. We feel joyful. We feel blissful. When we get inspired thoughts, they are uplifting thoughts. They're not put-down thoughts. We don't feel bad or we don't feel terrible about ourselves, but rather we feel inspired to live up to the very best in us. So those are the qualities we should look for. This doesn't mean to say that it gives us license to do whatever and wherever we want to. There's this definite law of karma, of cause and effect. And if we go against that, we pay a price for it. And so we should definitely avoid those things. We should keep this body in good health and do the things to do that. We should keep ourselves in emotional good health and healthy relationships, all the rest of it. But most of all, we should look for that joy. Sri Yukteswar and Yogananda both said that God was ever new joy. And it's hard to imagine when we're just used to material pleasure, because we get something for a while and it thrills us and then the thrill wears off and then we're on to the next thing. We don't know what that's like necessarily to know whatever new joy is. To have that joy well up in your spirit day after day and never tire of it. Only feel like you are going deeper into it, knowing it more and more and wanting more and more. And so it's whatever your conception of infinity is, let your mind grow to that. And then bust the doors off of that because it goes beyond that. In a human sense, we can't confine, we can't define what infinity is. God is so much more than what we could even conceptualize at this moment. It's fantastic, really. And this opens our direct intuitive pathways for knowing that infinity, for knowing God. I'll try to describe an experience that I once had. Oftentimes it's talked about in the spiritual path not to speak of your experiences because, one, is they're close and they're sacred, and sometimes you lose something by talking about it outwardly. But my own teacher asked me to teach from my own experience, so that's how I do it. It wasn't easy in the beginning because I always held it as close and sacred, but it gets easier with time. But I felt myself uplifted and went through the five-pointed star that we're told about in our meditation. And from that was just this totally losing body consciousness and expanding out in wave after wave of light, just going off into infinite reaches without any boundaries at all. The amount of freedom that was there, but the amount of expansion was something beyond anything I'd had up until then. And it was just such an incredible experience to feel that expansion just moving out and out and out without any limits, without any barriers. So what we're capable of is so much more than we normally grant ourselves. We confine ourselves in these little prisons when all the time we have a key that can unlock this doorway, that we can know our infinite consciousness.
David, I feel, when you talk about prison, I feel I'm stuck in the prison of the daily stresses of life and keeping up with, money and food and all our daily things.
Mm-hmm.
Does that tie in? Would that be seen as an illusion or something to break out of? I'm not quite sure how it.
If you carefully analyze your thoughts, I think what you'll find is that they are an attachment to a conception of how you think things should be, how you would like them to be, or what you're afraid they will not be. And so because of that, our minds are constantly running about what ifs. When we actually look at our lives, by and large, we usually say, I'm okay. If I have some shelter, if I have some food, if I'm not starving to death, I'm okay. So what's there to worry about? Dr. Lewis, a devotee of Masters, used to tell a story about why worry. He says, if you're living in a human body, you have only two things to worry about. Either you're healthy or you're ill. If you're healthy, there's nothing to worry about. If you're ill, there's only two things that you have to worry about, whether you will recover or whether you will die. If you recover, he said, no problem, nothing to worry about. If you die, there's only two things to worry about. He says, and that's either you go to heaven or you go to hell. He says, if you go to heaven, nothing to worry about. If you go to hell, you'll be so busy shaking hands with old friends, you won't have any time to worry. So why worry? So much of our worry and our anxiety is a result of really a habit pattern in our own brain, in our own mind. You think about the times perhaps when you've been driving someplace or walking someplace and you've been preoccupied with all the thoughts and worries in your head, and suddenly you come to and you see it's a bright, beautiful day and that perhaps there's flowers out and the trees smell and all the rest of it, and you hadn't even been conscious of any of that along the way. And we live in this trance 90% of the time. And sometimes people say, well, in my psychological work, do you use trances? And I said, well, I spend most of my time trying to get people out of trances, not into trances. So, we spend so much of our time entranced in these attachments to things of the world. So the thing is to simplify yourself. Bring yourself down to the moment. Bring yourself to the awareness of what you're doing, where you're at. Feel the presence of God there. Know, create that trusting attitude that God will take care of you, whatever the case, that He will inspire you. This doesn't mean that you get careless about your life or you don't pay attention to doing things, but that you keep your attention primarily on God. And there you find peace. So it's just the opposite of what you experience in the world. It's our attachment to those things of the world that keeps us from peace. So if we could let go of that and attach our minds to God, then we'll experience peace. We'll experience an incredible presence in the moment. But the mind's very quick. Boom, it's off here. 1,000 miles. Boom, off there. Another 1,000 miles. And it's repetitious. It goes around and around and around on the same thing. So it's not very efficient, and it's not very fun. But God is fun. You know, sometimes we don't think of God as, well, it's just this, you know. And it's not that at all. It's fun, and it's joy, and it's play, and it's all the rest of it. And so to really practice bringing our mind, and that's what meditation is for. Meditation starts out with concentration primarily. You concentrate on a place, or you concentrate on certain syllables or something, or a certain thought. And your mind will want to race off here and there and everywhere, and you continually bring it back. You bring it back over and over again. It's kind of like if you're training a dog and you're training him to heel. And boy, that puppy just wants to take off and just run after all the birds and go here and there and everywhere. Bring him back, down, bring him back, down, bring him back, down. Finally, he'll get the hang of it. And as you train him.
Kind of a thought, like, do you just pick one thought, positive thought, and you just, that's your focus for the meditation?
Well, in this path, what we teach is the Hong Sa method. And so the Hong Sa method is focusing your attention here at the third eye point. And the reason it's there is because we're told this is the doorway to God, perception. And so within the subtle nervous system, that's the astral body, there is this perceptual eye that's there, that when it opens you to this whole spiritual consciousness. It opens you into a whole new world. So you focus your mind here at the third eye point. When you breathe in, take a breath inwardly, you mentally repeat the word Hong, like Hong Kong. And as you naturally breathe out, you don't try to control your breath in any way. You just simply watch it. And as you breathe out, you repeat the word saw. It's spelled S-A-U, but it's like a hammer and saw. Now, these are two Sanskrit syllables that translate into I am spirit or I am he. And so these yogis have found out that every vibration carries with it either a positive or a negative connotation, or that it resonates with different levels of creation. These syllables resonate with your spiritual consciousness. And so you're constantly affirming, I am spirit, but it's also that vibrational rate that resonates right with your spiritual consciousness. And so you sit in a comfortable position with your spine upright. In all yogic practices, the spine is up and down. You close your eyes or half close your eyes, and you focus your attention here. Now, inside of your head, you have a mental eye that if you close your, you have a vision of things, and you can look right here. Sometimes in the beginning, it'll look just like a blank screen or something. But just put all of your attention there, and with each incoming breath, mentally repeat Hong. And each outgoing breath, mentally repeat Sa. And as you do this, you'll naturally come to the place where your breath will slow down. And you will come into a greater place of peace and quietness. So the analogy that's used is it's like a lake that when the wind is blowing over it, causes ripples and waves. But when the wind stops, it becomes perfectly placid and clear, and it reflects the mountains and the sun and the stars and the moon. And so in your own consciousness, when the wind of material desires and restlessness calm down, your mind becomes placid. And when that happens, you naturally begin to reflect those spiritual qualities that were always innate in you. As you practice that morning and night, then what you'll find is during the day at times, it'll just come on you suddenly. And you'll just have this immense feeling of peace just sweep through you. And you'll go, oh, that's nice. You know that you're on the right track. And more as you attach your mind to this practice, and you can practice it anytime, anywhere, and you get in touch with this peace and that feeling of peace, that feeling of spontaneous joy, then your mind will become, in a positive way, addicted to that, and less addicted to all the variations of the worldly concerns. You'll still have your world. You'll still do your things. You'll still have the things that you do in the world. But you'll have this presence constantly humming inside of you that brings you spontaneous joy and love and peace.
That's wonderful.
It is. It is. But it requires perseverance and absolute dedication, because this mind is so used to restlessness that it doesn't easily give it up. It's a habit, and it really hangs on to it. And so you have to really concentrate yourself 100%. And then if you add to that ingredient love for God, devotion for God, a desire to know God, then that just adds to the wellspring. And that, you know, when you think about it, what do you effortlessly do? And it's when you're in love with something. When you're in love with somebody or you're in love with something, anything, nothing is a problem. You'll sacrifice everything. You'll do everything for that beloved. When God becomes your beloved, you just naturally and spontaneously want to do everything for God. And then when you see God in every form, in every creation, then your life becomes just one massive love affair. And it's the most remarkable transformation that I think is possible in humanity. And it takes you into a brand new world. And where before you experienced despair and loneliness and frustration and all the rest of it, it brings you into the fullness of your own spirit.
So you look at painful things or difficult people in that light as well. It's all a message for us to be more compassionate. Or
yeah, there's a number of ways you can take it. You can see difficult people as God coming to you to test you. You can see it as God come to you in that manifestation to play with you. And Papa used to tell the story that God realization is like the child. And the child's mother hides behind this terrible looking mask. And that the child at first is frightened by the mask and doesn't know what to do. And finally it reaches up to the mother's hand and it pulls down the mask. And it sees behind the mask it's the mother. And then whenever the mask comes up, the child is in joyful play with it because it knows it's the mother behind the mask. When you recognize it's God behind every personality, where is the fear? It's just God who's come to you in that form. And so you just enjoy them in that, and you take it as that's God come to you in that form. Maybe to teach you humility, maybe to teach you courage, maybe just for you to love unconditionally, beyond all expression. Whatever the case is, it's your spiritual path. And then it transforms the world. All of a sudden, the world is full of friends. The world is full of God, and that's what's where is there to fear? So Jesus was able to say to the very people who were nailing him to a cross, "Forgive them, Father, they know not what they do." You have compassion, you feel their pain, because they're sentencing themselves to perhaps who knows how many lifetimes of working through that karma. And yet it's no ill will on Jesus' part. He just recognizes that they're living in darkness. And how much better it is to live in light. How much freedom there is there. If we have the choice, why not choose to live in light? But we're like the man who came upon this wonderful smelling thorn plant, had these beautiful white fragrant flowers. And the man became so entranced with it is that he came up and he just hugged the thorn plant. Well, those thorns embedded itself in his flesh. And he thought, well, what do I do now? But he is so entranced with the bush, he couldn't let go. So a saint was walking down the road, and he said, "Oh, kind sir," he says, "please release me from this bush." And the saint said, "Let go." "No, I can't. I can't. It's too intoxicating. I can't let go of it. Please release me from this bush." The saint said, "Let go." The man said, "I cannot. I cannot." The saint just shook his head and walked on. What was he to do? The man would not help himself. And so we are like that with this material world. Even though the thorns of desire and the consequences of our actions cause us pain, we are loath to let go. But if we only knew what was waiting for us, what was possible for us, we would make all best speed to get there. So it is up to us. A man once came to Master and said, "Master, please give me your blessings." Master said, "My blessings are there. God's blessings are there. All that's required now are your blessings." Well, because the teacher's mind is attuned to God's mind, then when you attune your mind to God's mind, God becomes the guru. It is all, when I experience my own teacher's vibration, it is pure God, and yet it has her signature on it in some way. And same with Master. And for the last 2 years, I've had these wonderful experiences with Lari Mahasya. One evening, we were walking in a park and speaking of him, and suddenly his presence became so real, I felt as if he just might materialize right in front of us. It was so, the air was so thick with his presence. And at one time, it felt totally pure, it felt totally like God. And yet it had his signature on it. You could tell that it was that personality. So it's a wonderful thing when you get into it and you start to open your perception doors to these great masters. But when you think, you know, most of us cannot conceive of God in a totally impersonal sense. It's difficult to see it as expanding light or to see it as expanding sound or any of the rest of it. So it's easier oftentimes in the beginning to focus on a form or some aspect of God. So if we focus in on that form and see that form within our own mind's eye, we hear that voice and those words resonating through our spirit, we focus in on that feeling that we experience that's the unique signature of that one, then we tune into that vibration. And with that vibration is that expanding spirit comes. And Jesus said, "I am a doorway." Now, no ordinary individual can say, "I am a doorway." People who have that ego sense in them become a closed door because the ego is there and you can't go beyond it. But the unique thing about someone who has realized their oneness with God is that you approach that and the doorway swings open and you enter straight into the spiritual realms. Because that one is not made up primarily of an ego sense, but of God vibration itself. And so as you experience the form, as you experience the sound, as you experience that feeling, that vibration, those all lead you in towards that attunement. And in the case of my own guru, it is recognizing the signature of her thoughts on my thoughts, the feeling of her vibration within my own self, and the sound of her own voice, although that's less common for me. What's most common is recognizing the signature of her thoughts on my thoughts. I know where those thoughts come from. Same thing with that feeling and that vibration. I know where that vibration comes from. And as you feel it and experience it and tune yourself into it, it expands your God perception. And so those are some of the ways to tune into that vibration. It's a very tricky area. It's not about human worship or man worship. It is because that consciousness of that one has become in tune with the divine that it has that capacity. But it's not about that individual. It is about God within that individual. And that's an important distinction. And whatever that individual may be in a human sense, you have to have an ego in the sense that in order to operate in the world, you have to have an identity. But when you have that inner attunement, then all of creation becomes a part of you. And yet you have that unique aspect of creation. So Master used to say, and Mother used to quote him often, God is the Master, we are all his disciples. And yet for me, focusing my mind on my Guru, on the form, on the voice, on the thoughts, on the vibration, help me in my own ascent. So I know from my own experience that that can be helpful. When I first was with Mother, I would come and see her, but I lived at a distant place. And I think there is many advantages in that in some ways, in that my mind became more attuned as I chanted inwardly and sang to God and became more attuned to it. I could feel her presence in me. And that has been the greatest gift, is that inner presence. That's an inner attunement that's not dependent on outward form. And that's where the Guru truly lives. Lari Mahasaya used to say that the Guru is here, the third eye point. Anytime that you focus your attention there, that is your Guru. And that is where God wisdom comes from. So it depends on the nature of the devotee, personal or impersonal. Both are all right. All filled up. What is it that's spiritual and non-spiritual? How can you divide up your life and say this is of God and this is not when it's all God?
You know what synesthesia is?
Pardon me?
You know what synesthesia is?
I'm not familiar with that term.
I was reminded of it by what you were saying earlier about how you can see through your feelings. There are actually books about it. It's a phenomenon in which different sensory stimuli become associated with one another. So, for example, there's a fellow in the States who was studied who, when he tasted peppermint, had a powerful sensation of cool blue columns that extended infinitely in either direction, that he could actually put his hand between and feel. And the fellow who was writing about it was a neurologist who argued that synesthesia was an ability that all people had. And that it was largely associated with the limbic system, which is kind of an older portion of the brain.
Right.
And I was just wondering, in light of that, if some of what goes on in meditation and seeing, if you've got any feelings about how those are reflected in brain events, where that activity takes place.
Yeah. Well, certainly, when you feel the higher centers open up, for instance, the Sahasrara, the crown chakra, you can feel the vital life energy go to the top of your head. and just literally take the top of your head off and you extend feet above it. And that powerful energy comes up in that way and goes along that. It's interesting. One of the interpretations that came up for the David and Goliath was Goliath being the ego, and David has the five stones, which are the five lower chakras. And with one of those stones, he hits Goliath in the middle of the forehead. Or in other words, that opening of the Christ center there happens. The ego is defeated. And my sister-in-law, Lois, who's a wonderful devotee, was going through Kundalini experiences not long ago. And her experience was that opening up of her head, and she was reading where David then chopped off the head of Goliath, and she thought that might be an interpretation of chopping off the head of Goliath, as it feels like your whole head gets removed during this process, which I think is an interesting interpretation of it. So you can actually feel the life force and the vitality come to your medulla very powerfully, and then come through your medulla to straight through to the third eye point here. And this is something that's a very real and definite experience. Also at the top of your head, and you can feel, I can feel it now as I'm talking to you, these cells at that part of your brain just tingling and vibrating with that vibrant energy. And so you can track exactly in your physiology where this divine life force goes to and how it operates on the brain and other parts of your body. Also in your heart center, an experience that I had there was just this tremendous pressure in my heart center that was almost so painful I wasn't sure I could take it any longer. But suddenly it was like a loosening of a knot. Mother Hamilton talked about it as the Gordian knot. And that loosening, and suddenly this just river of love flowed out from my heart center and just towards out all of creation. These things are so powerful and so profound that there is no confusing it for imagination or just thinking that you're thinking it, so therefore it is. So when you experience this intuitive perception, it's not a thing of imagination. But rather, you can see things through your feelings, you can hear things through your feelings, and vice versa. And it's not just an imaginative quality within the mind, because that's possible also. But it's something that comes to you spontaneously and intuitively. So these are all things that are part of the experiences in your ascension, from the human to the divine. But again, they are just experiences that you get. And so rather than focusing in on them, there's something that you are grateful for, you're thankful for, you let them pass on, and you keep your mind right on God the whole way. Does that answer your question, Earl? Or?
Yes.
You don't need to read books about it. You can have that experience right in your own human laboratory. But again, that's not something to focus your attention on or become attached to. The thing that I loved about this path, as Mother taught it, it's the most direct path that I know. It's a no-frills kind of operation. It's bare bones. And you get on with your work and you go directly where you're going. It's not a lot of fooling around. Because until your consciousness is anchored in the divine, you are likely to make errors, and making those errors, the higher you go up spiritually and psychically and powers and all the rest of it, the greater the consequences. So the safest way is to go directly to God, and then when you're in tune with that, that's highest spiritual consciousness, then you can act in total harmony. And you're not in danger of somehow harming yourself or others, which is otherwise the case. There are a million things we can spend our lifetime on. There's a wonderful story about a king one day who was coming toward the end of his life, and he had no heirs.